Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Seth, you mentioned the news item or the piece, I guess the feature piece in The Athletic about Deshaun taking pointers, Deshaun Watson and several quarterbacks taking pointers from a CEO of former CEO of some food services companies, who has since become a consultant, who uses chess, the game of chess, as a big piece of his platform with the consulting that he does with big companies. And this guy, who is not a football fan, he may be now, but he hadn't watched a football game until a couple of years ago, he's taken the concept of using chess as a way to help quarterbacks go through logical decision-making and thinking, and Deshaun is his prized pupil in this thing. And it's a really, it's a really, really compelling piece that, like most pieces about Deshaun Watson, have me feeling so good about this guy being the quarterback that this team intends to build around for the next decade. Because it's another angle to what I think we've already heard stories about Deshaun's sort of next-level intelligence at the quarterback position and just general intelligence as well. Graduated from college in 3 years. I mean, Deshaun is a smart, smart dude. The mere curiosity to make this a part of what Deshaun's makeup and what his regimen is, and his personal quarterbacks coach, Quincy Avery, is the one who brought this to him. But Deshaun's first meeting with this guy, his name is Seth Mikowski, was supposed to last 45 minutes. Deshaun moved back dinner plans and went 3 hours with the guy, talking through chess strategies, and immediately wanted to sit down with him again the next day.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was really cool.
I think Mikowski talking about Deshaun and the way he approaches this is really the most exciting thing, because we've heard about this from Deshaun before, and the problem is that everybody's got a rise and grind video out every week now about what hard workers they are, right? So it all becomes white noise. Yep. It almost becomes, okay, I kind of assume that all these guys are waking up at 3 a.m. and working out and doing the thing with the ropes, because that looks good on YouTube, you know, where they're doing the back and forth motion with the ropes and then some pull-ups or something. So that nobody believes anything anymore when you talk about how hard a guy is working. With quarterbacks, the last thing in the world I want to see is a quarterback working some physical drill, because it just doesn't matter in the NFL anymore. Even as the position gets more athletic, it's more based on the natural athleticism of guys that are good runners than it is on how much they improve their 5'10", 5 shuttle this year or something.
Yeah.
So with quarterbacks, what I want to see is how much of a nerd are you? Like, how much into the mental side of the game are you? That's why it used to drive me insane when people would call Tim Tebow a hard worker. Because when I would watch him play football, I could see that he works on his body, but who the hell cares? Give me a Peyton Manning body. I don't want to see a Tim Tebow body. Tim Tebow couldn't pick up the mental side of the game. He never adjusted to defenses in the NFL. He never adjusted to what it's like to play quarterback mentally in the NFL. He never put the time in on those things. It was obvious. It was evident from the way he played on the field, unless he's stupid, but he doesn't seem stupid. So I want to see a guy that's working on the mental stuff, and I've heard enough stories now about Deshaun and how much he cares about the mental side of the game that I think this year could end up being a really, really big leap for Deshaun, because this is typically when it starts to happen. For bright young quarterbacks, there's no amount of book studying that can replace game experience and taking things in at speed in a game and kind of processing and evaluating them and then learning how to apply it on the field. And I think whether it's Russell Wilson, some of these other young quarterbacks who have kind of taken that leap in year four, five, or six. I think this might be the year for Deshaun.
Here's another quote from the piece. It's a piece in The Athletic about Deshaun Watson working with Seth Mikowski, who is a CEO in the business world, but also an expert at playing chess, and the training centers around chess and decision-making. Here's another quote. By the end of the second session with Deshaun, Mikowski said he and Watson were playing chess without the pieces, solely based on board coordinates. And the quote from Mikowski is, that usually takes some people months to do. And Deshaun's doing it the second day that he's working with the guy. Seth, here's the other thing that as we start to try to bring this thing back to, okay, what does it mean to the Texans? What does it mean to Bill O'Brien and to Tim Kelly? And what does it mean to the long-term for this franchise? What does this mean from a football perspective? Like, what goal are they trying to have from a football perspective? I loved reading this, that Mikowski is working with Watson with career longevity in mind, making smarter, quicker decisions. And this is where I feel like the Venn diagram of what Mikowski is working on with Watson and what O'Brien, what we read about O'Brien and Kelly envisioning this offense being, starts to come together a little bit, right? Where they're flooding the field with these speedy receivers. They want Deshaun to get rid of the ball quicker. They want this. I feel like they want this thing to look a little more New England-ish in a way, where they're spreading the ball around and making quick hitting decisions. This is where maybe those two things start to overlap a little bit, where Deshaun working on the mental part of the game with this guy starts to mesh with what Kelly and O'Brien have in mind schematically for him.
Well, and if you think about quarterbacks in the NFL, there's a whole lot that, think about whether it's chess or checkers or any other game you've played. I'm speaking to anybody like driving in your car right now, where you think about any game you've ever played, you're always trying to find that balance, right, between thinking strategically ahead, but also being in the moment and making immediate decisions. Because what happens when you start thinking too strategically ahead? That's when all of a sudden you didn't even realize that there was a pawn next to your rook. I don't know chess. Yeah. But that's where you realize there was something right in front of me that I didn't see.
Right.
And yet you can't stop thinking about the stuff off in advance. So you got to kind of live in two worlds all at once. And for NFL quarterbacks, a lot of the times that becomes the very problem with some intelligent quarterbacks, is that they think too far in advance, and they all of a sudden, I'll say Ryan Fitzpatrick is like this. Ryan Fitzpatrick is thinking so far in advance that sometimes he completely misses the linebacker that's, you know, lurking in a zone.
Yeah.
or something like that. Jameis Winston does that too. Andrew Luck had that issue. Andrew Luck, really bright guy, had that issue of sometimes he didn't see the thing that was right in front of his face. And I think that's what, reading this article, it sounds like Deshaun is very conscious and aware of that and is trying to strike that right balance.
Yeah, and not only that, Mikowski mentions in this piece how good Deshaun is at moving on to the next play. Like Deshaun, in chess, apparently, because I'm with you, Seth, I don't play chess, although this article made me want to learn how to play better, because it feels like there's a lot of stuff that's translatable just in life, if you know, just in terms of the clarity of your thinking if you play chess, that there's a tendency with chess players, if they make a bad move, to dwell on it and let them affect their decision making on the next move and the next move and the next move. Mikowski says Deshaun is, you know, among the best he's seen at being able to just take a bad decision, flush it, and move on.
Yeah, and this is the perfect example why the Wunderlich score is it's overused. I think most football people know that, because they've seen enough guys that have a 45 Wunderlich score but don't necessarily look like the most brilliant guys on a football field. You know, Eli Manning's Wunderlich was I think substantially higher than Peyton Manning's Wunderlich.
Yeah.
You know, Eli was probably a better student in school, but I think Peyton, most people would say, is a more intelligent quarterback, because so much of it has to do with, it's almost as much about psychology as it is about book learning or anything you can study in your playbook.
Seth, I want to carry this over actually into the next segment, because this made me think of something as we got talking about the Texans and O'Brien and Kelly. I'm going to ask the question and then I'll give you the break to think about it. But what do we think O'Brien thinks of all the outside help that Deshaun gets in getting? Is it something he likes, or is it something that maybe, because it falls outside of the sphere of the stadium over there, something that maybe makes O'Brien a little tense?
You're asking whether Bill O'Brien's going to beat up this nerd Seth at some point this season.
In a manner of speaking.
I know exactly what you're asking.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that next. So Seth, I posed a question to you in the previous segment. We just got done talking about Deshaun Watson working with a chess expert to kind of tidy up and tighten up his mental game, his decision-making. And Deshaun is off the charts when it comes to the students of this guy. Among the other quarterbacks he's worked with was Dwayne Haskins, who comes across much better in this article than he did on the sidelines at Redskin games last year. He does not come across Dwayne Haskins as a guy who would be walking over and taking selfies with fans as he's supposed to be on the field taking a victory formation.
There's always, that is always the danger, by the way, in any interview with a guy that trains guys in the off season, because they are employees of the person you're talking
Good
about,
point.
Right? Like, this guy is an employee of Deshaun Watson, or at least Deshaun Watson is presumably paying him some money. So when someone, like, if somebody asks me something about my boss, and I know it's going to be publicly stated, I'm going to be quite glowing about it.
Yeah. For the record, Armin, if you're listening, Seth has been privately glowing about you as well, just so you know.
Oh, yeah, that. Yeah, that's right. Sometimes I have to dial it back when people ask me publicly about him.
That's right. So I asked you the question going into the last break, Seth, as we talked about this chess coach or this mental coach for Deshaun, who was discovered by Quincy Avery, who is Deshaun's personal quarterback's coach, who is very visible when it comes to Deshaun's preparation. And how do we think, or how do you think, Bill O'Brien feels about the outside help that Deshaun gets that seems to be so integral to his success?
I think most coaches are pretty cool with all that stuff, right? That's the modern NFL where ideally, wouldn't you much rather have a guy like Tom Brady who has a personal quarterbacks coach a throwing coach in Tom House than a guy that just doesn't seem to give a damn about it? Like I watched some of these quarterbacks. It used to drive me nuts with Matt Schaub. Like, how are you getting to a point in your career where your footwork is still so sloppy? Like, I don't understand how Tom Brady can spend an entire offseason working on the placement of his index finger and when he throws, and other quarterbacks just have their footwork all over the place and just horrible mechanics. I'd much rather have a guy that's obsessing over his mechanics in the offseason when, remember too, the NFL coaches aren't allowed to even physically work with the quarterbacks during the offseason.
Yeah.
So I think what it comes down to is what's the personality of the guy that's working with your quarterback? Is this a guy who's so egomaniacal and so selfish that he wants to be sure that Deshaun is giving him credit and not Bill O'Brien or anybody else? That's it's same way with guys' individual personal trainers in the off season. Like, yeah, you'd love to have a guy have a supervision when he's working out away from the facility. But sometimes these personal trainers think that, who, by the way, have never had to coach an entire team and don't know about those challenges, they'll just talk trash about the strength coach for the team the whole time, to when now all of a sudden the strength coach has to deal with 10 different guys who think what you're doing is wrong because you can't spend 4 hours of individual time working with bands and everything because you're trying to train a whole team.
I agree with you. My guess is that O'Brien is totally cool with it. I base that largely on the way that Bill O'Brien talks about Deshaun Watson and the clear respect he has for Deshaun's skill set, his intelligence, what he means to this franchise. And O'Brien knows that a lot of that intellectual curiosity, and look, a lot of the involvement from Quincy Avery, quite literally, are all things that led Deshaun to where he is now. So I think O'Brien's cool with it. The reason I think it's a fair question to wonder is that O'Brien, just in terms from a behavioral standpoint, is a guy who doesn't seem to mind controlling a lot of things. You know what I mean? He at one point was the play caller, general manager, and head coach of the team. And it, at least on the outside looking in, it looked like you almost had to pry the play calling out of his hands. He did it for a couple of years between Godsey and Tim Kelly. So I think it's at least a fair thing to wonder what he thinks about
that. Well, if you go back to the individual personalities, think about what happened with Tom Brady and his Alex Guerrera fella there.
Right.
His personal nutritional and exercise guru. Belichick did not like the influence that Guerrero had on the rest of the team because it felt like, according to various stories we've read, it felt a little bit like he was undermining what the Patriots and their staff were trying to tell their athletes. And coaches don't like that. Like, you hit the nail on the head. It's a matter of control.
Yeah.
So does Bill O'Brien who's, yeah, like a lot of NFL coaches, is a bit of a control freak. It's almost a job requirement. Does he feel like, okay, do any of these outside guys, are they starting to mess with my ability to have control over my program? I haven't sensed that or heard that about Deshaun and his people, so I would imagine he's cool with
it. Yeah, I think so, too. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Thursday morning here, Sports Radio 610. Seth, the college football still continues to be just one big cluster bleep compared to the other sports. It's July 2nd, and none of us have any clue as to what or if there's going to be what it's going to look like, or even if there's going to be something to scrutinize when it comes to college football. And there was a story yesterday that the Pac-12 has a conference call, an ongoing conference call. I'd imagine most conferences are doing this, but this story was about the Pac-12, where they have medical experts on a conference call with Pac-12 decision makers. And there's one Power 5 AD in the Pac-12 that says that the most asked question that they get from their athletes is it okay for them to attempt to contract the coronavirus now so that it doesn't interfere with their seasons? This is basically something that athletes are actively asking people in charge right now.
Which is basically like the concept of the old chicken pox party, right? Before they had a vaccine for chicken pox.
I never knew there was such thing as a pox party. It has its own wiki page.
Oh really? I kind of knew. I thought it was something they did in the 1800s or something. I didn't know that it was a thing that people did. But yeah, it used to be back in the day before there was a measles and a chickenpox vaccine. Some people would just if one kid got it, at the very least, they might want to try to get all the other kids to get it, because you were gonna get. I don't know. I had chickenpox. I think almost everybody had chickenpox.
Yes.
Right? You're gonna get it at some point. And there was a certain risk associated with that. But there was no vaccine, and everybody was going to get it at some point. The biggest difference between chicken pox and COVID is that we don't know squat about COVID.
Right.
Like, we know very little. We know some things about the death rate, and we know some things about underlying conditions, but we really don't know what the long-term effects are, both cardiac and pulmonary, amongst people that don't die. Like, so even people, we don't know whether people that are asymptomatic, at least consciously, might still have lung damage further on down the line. And I think that's where there's been maybe too much of a focus on hospitalization and death rate, just because we flat out don't know exactly what happens to all these people that maybe only have mild sickness, or they feel pretty sick, but then they go on and they don't report it. There's not a lot of knowledge or information on that right now.
Yeah, I guess the flaws in the logic that are outlined in this piece, to your point, Seth, they studied 74 asymptomatic patients, and the antibodies fell off drastically over 3 months for asymptomatic patients. And the less the symptoms were, the weaker the antibodies were for those folks.
Right. And that one, and the experts addressed that in there. It's hard to know exactly what to take from that study, because those are the people that fought it off successfully. They might have fought it off with T cells more effectively than other people have. The antibodies, they might have an antibody response that's very fast, but then fades very quickly. So they flat out don't know. But what they're saying is, we don't know how long the immunity lasts. In a lot of viruses, you're going to get immunity, but sometimes it's only a couple months, and others it's for the rest of your life. And they just don't know about that. So if you have the notion that, hey, like these kids at Alabama that are all getting together and trying to get the COVID, like, okay, you might be doing that just so you can get it again 3 months from now.
Yeah.
It's not. And like right now, if you are one of the young people that gets hospitalized, they found that of the people that have been hospitalized, they have a 1 in 5 chance of injury to their heart or injury to their lungs that can be long term.
Right.
So, you know, the death rate's very low in young people. The hospitalization rate isn't as low. And there's a good chance that if you end up being hospitalized with it, that you could potentially have lung and heart. Yeah. Like, we have to find some level of risk that's appropriate for everybody. But in terms of going out and intentionally getting it, I can't imagine there's too many medical professionals that think that's a good idea.
No, right, the ones in this article sure didn't. They said don't count on herd immunity. And Clemson's football team was brought up as sort of the, at least within the football realm, sort of the you know, the quasi petri dish for that sort of thing, because they've had 37 football players, I think 37, and maybe more than that now, report positive COVID cases at Clemson.
Yeah. So, and there's a, I don't know, there. there's this issue of chronic inflammation that people are getting afterwards that they can't quite figure it out. And there's, it mirrors some of the stuff that, there's a syndrome called chronic inflammatory response syndrome that mirrors a lot of, I don't want to get too far off into a tangent. There's stuff we don't know about this injury.
Yeah. I think, you know, what we know, the athletes that we know of that have had it, Von Miller has probably, he's probably got the most drastic story that we've heard. And part of that is he has asthma. So he was really feeling the effects of it. Rudy Gobert, who was, to me, he's sort of the poster child for athletes getting coronavirus because his positive case shut down the league. He is saying that, Seth, even these months later, he still is, his sense of taste has not come back yet. Which, yeah. I guess of all the things, if all the things that are going to linger.
Wait, who was that said the taste hadn't come
Rudy
back?
Gobert.
Rudy Gobert, oh, okay. Yeah, Rudy Sorry, Gobert. I'm reading here, he said he hasn't captured his smell, which I would imagine is his taste as well.
It's tied to it, yeah. They're linked, so there you go. All right, the NFL has made its first significant decision in this offseason of the coronavirus. We'll have it for you next. The NFL has made its first true kind of revenue-impacting decision. I don't say it's its biggest decision. Some would say that marching forth with the season right now would be their biggest decision, but I don't know that decision is final yet. We got to wait and see how things play out over the next couple of months. As of right now, the NFL still intends to open the season Thursday night, September 10th, in Kansas City with the Houston Texans taking on the Kansas City Chiefs. There will, however, not be a week one and week four of the preseason schedule. The league announcing yesterday that they are going to be canceling weeks one and four. So for the Texans, that means no game, home game or no road game against Seattle, and no home game against the Dallas Cowboys. Interesting little wrinkle, Seth. That's two of the last 4 years that the Cowboys' preseason game with the Texans has been canceled for drastic, disastrous reasons. This year, the COVID, and 3 years ago, Hurricane Harvey.
For Harvey,
denied us of the Governor's Cup.
Hurricane Harvey led us to a Super Bowl, to a World Series championship. But then Harvey also created Deshaun Watson's torn ACL. Harvey both delivered us Deshaun Watson, and by that I mean that allowed him to actually start a football game instead of going through this dog and pony show of pretending that he wasn't the best quarterback on the team all training camp long. Yeah. Oh man! Whoa! Why did I have to get back to there? I don't have to think about that.
Tom Savage starting week one. What's going through your brain right now?
Now I'm angry again. So it didn't predict great things necessarily for the Texans that season.
No.
But the fourth preseason game, getting rid of the fourth preseason game doesn't do much to anybody on the actual football team. It does hurt your rookies with their chances of. If not, usually going into that fourth preseason game, the roster for the most part is already set. But I think in terms of guys, some guys having a great performance in that fourth preseason game actually earns them a spot on the roster, or at the very least, it puts out some really good film for other teams to see.
Yeah.
So what you're doing, and this is what you tell rookies in training camp every year, and a lot of times you say it because they're starting to get down on how many reps they're getting or what have you. We have to remember when you're a rookie is that you're auditioning for every team in the league. Mm-hmm. It's not just the Houston Texans. It's every time you're on film, every time you have a combined practice with somebody else, those coaches are looking for guys like you.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a numbers crunch on the Texans and you don't make the team because they already got a bunch of outside linebackers. Then in that fourth preseason game, you ball out and man, you got a much better chance of getting picked up. So I feel bad for those younger guys that they're going to have far fewer opportunities to do that.
Yeah, I like the we know what the preseason had become, Seth. The preseason had become more of a platform for what it is you're talking about. There were a lot of teams, Texans included, that played their starters barely at all, if at all. And you know, some of the veterans got the entire preseason off from playing in preseason games. So it had become more that. But I wonder how much more valuable a commodity these two preseason games become in terms of the preparation for the season, because you're not going to have the joint practices now either.
That's a great point. That's a great point, Sean, when it comes to, okay, guys that you're going to need to rely on when they come in. Every year you have some rookie that you never thought might even make the team that all of a sudden is starting in week 13 because you had a rash of injuries on the offensive line or somewhere else. And now you might be relying on guys that weren't even getting any kind of reps in games during the preseason or what have you. It's a much bigger gamble. And I wonder where, I think partly by design, partly by just dumb luck, the Texans have a more veteran team. The Texans don't have as many rookies. They traded away a lot of those draft picks before they ever knew the COVID was going to be a thing.
Right.
But then by the time they got to the draft.
The Tunsil trade, O'Brien steps up to the microphone. He's like, look, a lot of people haven't looked, but we've seen down the road, and there is a pandemic coming in 2020, and we're going to need to have a veteran team.
What if it turned out, you know, now they're going back and they're doing all these studies where they're looking at satellite images of parking lots in China back last autumn, and people are wondering, okay, wait a second, they dialed back on activity in Wuhan way sooner than we would have thought, given the dates of the, so maybe Bill O'Brien in whatever spying friends he still has back in New England, somebody at the NSA or something to clue him into the COVID.
Sending him
threat.
Some screen caps of Wuhan so he can do his roster.
What was the Cooks trade?
His roster planning. The Cooks trade was after the Hopkins trade, which the day of the Hopkins trade was the day I got back from my honeymoon, and 3 days later you and I were doing our shows from home. So the Hopkins trade came 5 days after the NBA shut down the season.
April 9th, it was reported here at least. I don't know whether they have it on the 9th or the 8th or whatever, but that was when we were in the midst of the pandemic and the shutdown and everything. So and O'Brien had mentioned it the next time he talked to the media about it was going to be a veteran type of year.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting. That's a really, because at that time too, there were still concerns over potentially the lockout affecting things. But he knew that it was going to be a veteran kind of year. I feel like the Cooks trade was going to get done regardless because Jack Easterby just flat out loves Brandon Cooks so
yes.
much.
Yes, yeah.
He's like Jack Easterby's prize pupil. So mm-hmm. I will say that the Texans, whether you want to credit Bill O'Brien for it or not, might be more suited to these circumstances right now than a lot of other teams.
Between the veteran core and between the fact that, as we've illustrated a few times on the show today, you have a quarterback who is just next level when it comes to absorbing the system, leadership, all of those things. Like Deshaun Watson, independent of the situation we're all in now with COVID, Deshaun Watson already covers up a lot of flaws on whatever team he's on. And I think one of the flaws he's going to cover up is nothing that's the Texans' fault. It's going to be a potential flaw for all 32 teams, which is preparation's going to be really hard this offseason to get ready for the regular season. And it just got harder by getting rid of a couple of those preseason games. Do you think they wind up playing the two preseason games that are on the schedule, Seth? If you were, I know it's purely a guess, but if you were a betting man, what would you bet?
I think they will.
Yeah.
And again, I think some people are jumping. The people we have scads of people that either on Twitter or on our text page, they feel it's really important for us to understand that we're idiots if we think sports are going to be played at all.
Right.
I think that you're an idiot if you think that sports are going to be played in front of huge crowds of people.
Mm-hmm.
That's unlikely. Maybe by the end of the season something will have developed with a vaccine or something, but that's unlikely. In terms of sports actually being played, with these bubbles that people are creating, it's not far off or much different than what a lot of workplaces that are already back up and running are doing right now. And it's just going to be that you're going to get positive cases. You're going to have to monitor it. It might be lethal to some teams' chances this year because they're going to have a really bad stretch of it. But I think you're going to be able to keep outbreaks isolated within individual teams, at least. And because of that, you're going to continue to have a season.
Seth, I would say that more than any other season ever, that the preseason games are going to be necessary for the people that run the stadium. You know what I mean? There are going to be more measures in play, even without a crowd, but especially if they're going to let people into games, there are going to be more things than ever that the people responsible for the game day experience are going to need to be implementing here that they haven't implemented before, whether it's social distancing procedures, food and beverage distribution, for the sideline of the team. There's going to be enough stuff for the Texans to install from a football standpoint. There's going to be stuff that they're going to be wanting to practice just from a sideline mechanics standpoint. So I almost feel like these two preseason games are not only necessary for the teams themselves, they're necessary for the teams of people that run the stadium on game day because of how different this whole game day atmosphere is going to be. Whether there's zero fans or 50% or whatever the percent is, there are going to be things in place that the operations people that run the stadium on game day are going to be doing that they've never done before. And in some ways, so for the Texans, that would be a home game against the Minnesota Vikings the third week of August. I would imagine that the operations staff on game day is going to be gathering that day. And we got to treat this like this is a regular season game kind of thing. We all these things that we've been talking about on these conference calls, we got to go execute these things now and make sure that when the real games get here, that our plan works. We can't be doing this in week two when Baltimore gets here and be endangering people.
Yeah, so it'll be sloppy, it'll be messy, there'll be a lot of mistakes made along the way. Friends will become enemies, enemies will become friends, and at the end of it all, there will be football of some sort played.
Yeah.
We don't know whether they'll make it through an entire season or what have you. I do wonder if there's some kind of a contingency plan where they go to bubble. Like, is there a DEFCON 1 where all of a sudden that's where everybody goes into a bubble somewhere? Maybe a bunker in West Virginia or something.
Oh, man. Can you imagine? Can you imagine moving football on the fly into pods somewhere? My guess is it can't be one place. Maybe you do it. Maybe they've got like three cities identified, and you do east, central, and west part of the United States.
Look, if there's one thing I've learned along with this pandemic, Sean, it's that the people at both extremes are going to be wrong almost every single time.
Yeah.
It's not going to be 10 million people dead, but it's certainly not going to be a dozen people dead. It's, and we had people 3 months ago that were adamant that, we'll be lucky. It'll be a tragedy of 50 people dying this thing.
Yeah.
So, and they were supremely confident of that. So, okay, obviously they were very, very wrong about that. But likewise, the most dire predictions haven't quite come to bear, but not to say that it is awful things haven't happened. It's just, it's somewhere in the middle, like most things in life. So right now, when it comes to, okay, complete shutdown with no football played whatsoever versus, hey, we're going to pack the stadiums by Thanksgiving, both of those are likely wrong.
Yeah.
It's going to be somewhere in the middle.
The Payne and Pendergast with you on a Thursday morning here, Sports Radio 610. We're at the stage of the pandemic, we really need sports back. Stage, Seth, where The Athletic is running a bunch of different polls about food-related things, and they have 22 questions that over 2,000 readers responded to about various game day sort of eating habits, and I'm not going to go through all 22 questions. I am curious your thoughts on some of these, because I feel like these are actually things that I think Landry would get into heated arguments about John Lopez.
Yeah, for the life of me, I've never understood the psychology that goes into thinking that your individual taste preferences are better than somebody else's individual taste preferences, other than an extreme egomania that prevents you from seeing outside of your own experience.
Right. That said, what is your answer to this question?
Because
this is a controversial question for people in Houston that love their mustard and relish. Your friend puts ketchup on his hot dog. Do you A, steal the hot dog and eat it for yourself, B, say nothing, or C, slap the hot dog out of their hand?
I guess I would say B, I would do nothing. I would think nothing of it. Because like 51% of Americans, I put ketchup on my hot dog.
You do?
And the 49 other percent that act like it's the weirdest thing that's ever happened. I have to ask you, like, when were you first allowed to leave your house? Were you 23? Like, how are you this sheltered in this life that the concept of somebody putting a different condiment on your hot dog is earth shattering?
I think the misconception, first of all, my personal taste, I think ketchup on a hot dog, not very good, but it's cool. You're right. A lot of people do it. I think the misconception, and with ketchup in general, is that it's a juvenile condiment. That somehow if you put ketchup on things, like the insult that I see hurled at people like yourself that put ketchup on hot dogs is, oh, does your mom make mac and cheese to go with it for you? I feel like mac and cheese gets a bad rap too, actually.
I don't understand why would ketchup be viewed that way.
I don't know.
There's so much sugar in it because it's more of like a sugary thing.
I don't know.
But I don't. You know what I honestly feel, Sean? Yeah. I feel like most people that feel that way, I feel like they're also racists. I think that these are people that are looking for ways to separate human beings into different categories, and they'll do it like with anything at their disposal, whether it be skin color or condiment choice.
Yeah.
So I say I cancel all of you. I cancel all of you for judging my ketchup choices.
Condimentists is what they
are.
Yeah. Dollar hot dog night. You're trying to impress a friend. How many dollar hot dogs do you eat at the game?
Okay, I wouldn't be trying to impress my friend with eating. I stopped that by the time I was
okay,
like
what if I'm the friend
old.
That you're going with, someone who has judged the Nathan's hot dog eating contest, not once but twice,
oh,
and you're trying to impress me.
I don't know. Like, I know I wouldn't be able to impress you because you've watched professionals in action.
Yeah.
It'd be like sleeping with a porn star. I think that I think I could eat like eight is no big deal. I get like eight seems about like that's about the amount. Yeah, eight.
Wow, that's a lot of hot dogs, man.
I mean, spread out over the course of a game, that's just
true.
One hot dog per inning until the ninth, you know?
For most American League baseball games, it's like one hot dog per hour.
Yeah.
Let's see here.
Not this year.
Seth, have you ever grabbed a stranger's souvenir cup or Sunday helmet that they've left behind at a game?
I can't remember that I have, but I definitely would. I like the souvenir cups. I'm a big fan of the souvenir cups.
Do you like
it? Because it's a memory. Like every time you drink out of it, you're like, oh, yeah, I remember that day. That was nice.
I can't imagine you're not a fan of the souvenir helmet Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like
it lowers the bar for quality of ice cream that you need by far. Like it could be a soup of sugar and milk, and it would taste good if eaten out of that thing.
Right.
Well, you know what? I think Amy gave me an old commemorative Texans cup.
She did.
That had like a hologram me on it.
It did, yeah.
Which we've got that up in our cupboard right now. It's one of the few things that I can show my daughter to let her know that I used to be somebody.
To prove that I played in the league. That in a Game Pass subscription. Well, not even
Hey, just remember when you sass me that you're talking to a guy who was once commemorated in hologram form on a cup.
On a cup.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, and here it is right above my bed. Do you tip the concessions counter workers at a stadium?
If I have spare change, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not going to go out of my way to do it.
Do you tip for beer, though? Do you give like an extra dollar for beer? I definitely tip the ones that carry the crate of beers around to the seats. You know, beer here, cold beer here. I always tip them. The counter workers, I'm with you. Like whatever's left over from what I give them here, you can have the rest, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't. And then the other thing, too, is if I'm feeling particularly charitable or if I'm feeling bad about myself and I feel like I need to do penance, then sometimes I'll throw in a larger bill for that. On Christmas, I don't pay in cash anymore at so many places. I used to go around, like if a place was open on Christmas, like a coffee shop or something, I'd throw a 20 in there.
Okay.
You know, it was like a Feliz Navidad. Thanks for working on Christmas.
Yeah.
And you know, the person's like, what the hell do I care? I'm Jewish anyway. And, but you know, the smart ones are like, oh, thank you so much. It was a real sacrifice.
Yeah. 46% of the people say they don't tip concessions counter workers. However, 68% of the people do tip the vendor in the stands who sell you beer. So I feel like I'm in line with that.
Yeah, you feel like they're working, they're putting in physical labor there. Yeah.
What percentage of people, Seth, do you think trust ballpark sushi?
I know you do, and I know I don't. So 50. 50%. based on my focus group of two people, 50%.
Can I just tell you what my reaction was to what you just said? Because I don't know that I've ever brought up on the show whether or not I trust ballpark sushi. My first reaction was, hey, Seth, you can't speak for me. And then I immediately went, but I do trust ballpark sushi.
Yeah, because you were going on and on before the show the other day about this cheap little discount sushi place.
Oh, yeah, I was. It's
delicious.
It
doesn't even feel like a sushi
place. I'm going there tonight. Yeah, I can't wait.
I'm like, oh, that pretty much sounds like you pretty much described Al's from Happy Days, but they sell sushi instead. I'm like, no.
Now that you bring that up, you were not out of line one even tiny little bit to bring.
Like some fat Italian guy with a belly tee on, you know, and stains on his shirt brought his sushi out.
You're just sashimi that I can't even pronounce. 61% say no, they would not trust ballpark sushi.
Sounds pretty close.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's pretty good. All right.
I don't trust, and I'm going to say that I don't trust, if I'm eating sushi, it's got to come from a place that's pretty sparkling clean. And then, and even like the high end grocery stores that sell sushi, I don't do it there either.
Okay,
I'm very, very careful. About
let me ask you this, and we'll ask him at 9:35 when we bring him on. Do you think Darren Revelle trusts ballpark sushi?
No, I don't.
Okay, you're gonna go with no. Yeah, I think no is the right answer too. Well, that'll be the first question we hit him with when we get him on at 9:35. All right. Payne and Pendergast with you on a Thursday here, Sports Radio 610. Which franchise tag players get long-term deals over the next couple weeks? This is the last hour in studio here for a couple of weeks. By the time Seth comes back, the July 15th deadline will have come and gone. Do we think any of these guys get deals? We'll go through the more interesting ones next.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.